first one was about 35'10", and the second was about 27'2".
Barrow Whaling Crews land two bowheads. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 3rd of May. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a ballot initiative brings together an odd assortment of opponents.
There's a coalition of people who don't often agree and are politically, you know, on the other side of issues a lot of times, who are going, wait a minute, this is just bad policy for Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Does your child not look at you when you talk to him? Are you worried your child doesn't play with other children? Or do you wonder why your child seems to be in her own world? Well, these could be the early signs of autism. For more information about autism and resources in your community, visit autism.alaska.gov or call 1-800-799-7570. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Barrow is celebrating its first successes in the spring whale hunt. Separate crews landed two whales over the weekend. Eugene Brower is president of the Barrow Whaling Captains Association. He says right now hunting conditions are ideal, but a windy spring has forced the hunters further from the village.
About 4 to 6 miles out, depending on the location. Or if not closer, maybe a couple miles, 3 miles out. So the conditions are good. You just got to know the conditions of the ice and where you're going.
Brower says a lot of whales are migrating now and expects more crews will have success soon. The biggest whale landed was about 36 feet long and weighed 36 tons. But Brower says it doesn't take long for the community to prepare the meat.
The two whales have already been butchered. The community comes out along with the representatives from the other two whaling crews. They go help pull the whale up on top of the ice and butcher it and it's distributed evenly.
He says today, Barrow residents are getting ready for the first potluck celebrating the successful hunt.
They'll cook a portion of the whale. They'll cut half of the heart, one half of the kidney, half of the small intestines, cook them along with the meat, the tongue, and a 12-inch strip of muktuk close to the belly, all the way around the body. That's cut into small strips and cooked, and they feed the whole tongue with that.
Gamble is the only other village that has reported landing a whale this spring. A crew there caught the first whale of the season on Easter Sunday. Some of Alaska's historic documents and photographs are getting a new lease on life. A specialist in paper preservation and restoration is traveling to several museums around the state for most of this year. The conservator just spent a month at the local museum in Petersburg. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
What is this documentary?
It's some sort of climbing document. It's a climbing log, and it was essentially a document where the climber signed it every time they climbed it. And
in his temporary workshop at the Clausen Memorial Museum, Seth Irwin describes a tattered and stained piece of paper. It's a summit register from Devil's Thumb, a sheer 9,000-foot peak on the mainland across Frederick Sound from Petersburg. Climbers Fred Becky, Paul Craig, and Clifford Schmidke first left the paper with their signatures there in 1946. Subsequent climbers added their names to the historic record, but it's pretty deteriorated after more than 60 years on the mountain. It's one of the projects Irwin's been working on in Petersburg.
Yeah, it was essentially kept on the mountain in a metal can, and as you can tell, it's rusted over completely, and removing the rust requires chemicals that I'm going through great difficulty to get.
Irwin is a paper conservator with a master's degree from Queen's University in Ontario. He's trained in the treatment of paper-based museum artifacts.
Conserving them to prevent them from getting damaged, and then if they do get damaged, I'm trained in most ways of fixing them.
He's not only here to fix things. Most small museums cannot afford to do complicated paper conservation work on their own. But as he travels around Alaska, Irwin is teaching local museum staff how to do some basic repairs and preservation.
For example, I'm sure you can see in the corner over there, they've got all those rolled photographs. I'm going through training on how to unroll photographs, which is a big problem. You can't just unroll them, they crack. So you have to unroll them over a period of time in a humidity chamber. So I've been, that's one of the steps that I've been working on. The other one is how to create good enclosures, how to make sleeves and enclosures for objects, how to make boxes for books, things like that.
Irwin's month-long stay in Petersburg was funded through a $5,000 grant from the Rasmussen Foundation. He was at the Valdez Museum before that. Next, he goes on to the Alaska State Museum in Juneau, then on to the Anchorage Museum at Rasmussen Center, the Aviation Heritage Museum, a variety of Kenai institutions, and the Dorothy Page Museum in Wasilla. Scott Carley is curator of museum services for the Alaska State Museum in Juneau. He says there are a few conservators in Alaska, but their expertise is in three-dimensional objects, not paper.
None of us are trained in paper conservation. And it's a pretty rare thing to have a paper conservator in Alaska. I've been sort of tracking the history of art conservators in Alaska, and really there's only been two or three times in the history that I know of that a paper conservator has come to Alaska to do work. So most of the time we have to send out objects, and really only expensive or very fancy, you know, objects would get sent out. There's just a lot of unmet need in the state.
Alaska's Division of Archives, Libraries, and Museums is working to meet some of those needs by building a new facility behind the state museum. Now in the planning stages, that project would include a new paper conservation lab. The building would be funded with a $20 million bond measure that requires voter approval. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
People rallied in Juneau and Anchorage this weekend against Ballot Measure 1. That's the initiative sponsored by libertarian lawyer Scott Kohlhaas that would attempt to limit Alaskans' access to the political process and to politicians. In Juneau, representatives of labor unions, senior activists, education, and municipal governments attended the Saturday event at the Diamond Courthouse across the street from the Capitol, most of them wearing gags over their mouths to demonstrate their view of the initiative as an anti-free speech measure. Alaska Municipal League Executive Director Kathy Wasserman told the audience that the initiative will ruin the people's constitutional rights, reminding them that, quote, we don't need to put up with this.
This isn't going to work for the state of Alaska. For someone to come into the state of Alaska from somewhere else and tell us that they want us to be quiet and not take part in government or campaigning or lobbying or influencing or whatever else is on that five pages of dribble is not something that we're going to stand for.
Wasserman says the initiative is on the ballot because people were hired to collect petition signatures by an out-of-state individual with a personal agenda. The initiative prohibits anyone with any income of $500 or more from any level of government from taking part in any political campaign or lobbying activity, even speaking to a legislator. About 75 attended a similar rally in Anchorage. People gathered on the lawn of the Lusac Library in Anchorage holding signs with statements like, confused? Vote no on Measure 1 and leave my grandma out of this. Alaska AFL-CIO President Vince Beltrami says the definition of immediate family is one of the big problems with what he says is the vast overreach of Measure 1. The language would make it illegal for a family member of someone with a state contract from contributing to a campaign. But Beltrami says the definition includes step brothers, cousins, and parents-in-law.
That would absolutely be eliminated from the political process. And then what really makes it hard if you're a candidate, you're looking for campaign contributions, trying to raise money, and you don't know if you're accepting a contribution, if you may have just broken the law by accepting a contribution from the step-grandparent of someone who happens to have a state contract, and then that potential legislator has, committed a criminal act.
Beltrami says the coalition of those opposed to the measure is gaining ground with trade unions and public employees.
Like the Associated General Contractors, the Alaska State Chamber. I mean, so you're seeing that there's a coalition of people who don't often agree and are politically, you know, on the other side of issues a lot of times who are going, wait a minute, this is just bad policy for Alaska.
Joelle Hall is Director of Operations for AFL-CIO and the manager for the Stop the Gag Law campaign. She says everything about the measure upsets her.
I'm a veteran and I'm married to a soldier, and I find the whole First Amendment attack, of course I find that offensive. And I think that it's just a kind of a sad and cynical attempt to manipulate Alaskans in light of our recent history. And that bugs me, too.
Hall says the measure's restrictions will impact nearly all Alaskans. It will be voted on during the August primary election. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, small bird, big personality. A look at Alaska's hummingbirds.
They're very territorial and they interact with each other often in a loud way with their chattering calls.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
The University of Alaska received solid support for general operations under the budget passed by the legislature last month. The $341 million UA operating budget is 3.9% larger than the current year's budget and $433,000 above what the governor's requested. UA spokeswoman Kate Ripley says that's good, but specific money for key programs is missing from the FY11 budget.
We did receive some funds there, but not enough to really move some of these programs in energy, science, technology, engineering, and math, and climate change forward.
Ripley says conspicuously absent is additional funding for UA health programs.
That's an area where the university has really been expanding. There's a desperate need out there, not just for nurses, but for a number of different occupations in allied health fields, and that's going to be challenging to work with that.
The capital budget is also a mixed bag for university. On the plus side, Ripley cites $37.5 million for deferred maintenance.
That's always the number one priority here, and the governor really got behind that, and so we're going to see some of these issues be addressed. In Fairbanks, the Scarland Hall improvements are top of the list.
Ripley says the biggest disappointment in the capital budget is the absence of money for a new life sciences building.
The life sciences building is something that's desperately needed for the university and for the state of Alaska, and it actually brings in money.
Ripley says the research capacity at the university is starting to level off due to a lack of quality space. The UA region's priority project was lumped into a nearly $400 million statewide bond package voters will consider. The Tlingit and Haida Central Council and Sea Alaska Heritage Institute will work together as both organizations seek to build native cultural centers in Juneau. Tlingit and Haida has nixed an idea to build a culture center and tribal college at the downtown Juneau property known as The Pit. Delegates to last month's tribal assembly meeting voted down a resolution to purchase the former Juneau Town Center site for $800,000. Meanwhile, Sea Alaska Heritage is waiting to find out if it will receive $4 million in this year's state capital budget for a separate center at Sea Alaska corporate headquarters. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Newly elected Tlingit and Haida President Ed Thomas says the culture center needs to be more thoroughly vetted. Though the $800,000 asking price for the property may be a good deal at $145,000 less than the assessed value, construction costs are estimated at $15 million. Thomas says Tlingit and Haida can't afford to undertake that kind of project.
I think our people really do believe that it would be a nice thing to have a culture center, a tribal college. My feeling is that if we are really going to go that direction, we need to make sure we have the money to do so. Not buy the property and then try to find the money.
Outgoing Tlingit and Haida President Bill Martin supported the Culture Center project at the Pit. The property at the corner of Seward and Front Streets had been the site of a 108-year-old building, which burned down in 2004. Martin saw the project as an opportunity to revitalize downtown Juneau. He's disappointed, but accepts the decision of the tribal assembly.
When a decision is made by the people, we stand by it. We don't try to disparage it or say they were wrong or anything like that. You know, you can stay disappointed. It's just that the people have all spoken, and so that's what I'll go by, and I'll support that.
The Central Council instead passed a resolution directing Tlingit and Haida administration to work with other Native groups on a culture center project, including Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Thomas says he supports that approach not only because of the cost of the facility, but also because he thinks local Native groups should collaborate.
To have a comprehensive plan instead of just a single organization trying to deal with the complex issues of our culture.
Sea Alaska Heritage received $4 million in this year's state capital budget toward a proposed $16 million facility to house artifacts, books, photos, and recordings. It still has to survive Governor Sean Parnell's veto pen. SHI President Rosita Worrell says it would be separate from Tlingit and Haida's project.
We, you know, looked at our plans and our objectives, and it was really clear that we were talking about two different kinds of cultural centers.
Worrell, however, says the two organizations often work together and support each other's efforts.
I think we all share the same kind of objectives in terms of advancing the welfare of our people. And so, you know, we have common concerns, and we know that we're stronger when we work together.
Worrell says the project would likely be an expansion of Sea Alaska's corporate headquarters downtown, though other options are being considered. Martin says he hopes Tlingit and Haida's Culture Center will also be located downtown.
I like the downtown area because, you know, Juneau gets a million tourists every year, and we see a lot of them walking around downtown and just looking for things themselves. And so I thought there'd be a lot of passerbys. We would take advantage of the tourists that were just actually walking around downtown.
The airport area also has been discussed as a possible site for the Tlingit and Haida Center, but Martin says it would miss out on a lot of foot traffic if it's not downtown. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The ice went out on the Yukon River at Eagle last week. Eagle residents had been watching to see what the Yukon would do a year after breakup inundated the town with water and ice that destroyed dozens of buildings and other property. Longtime Eagle resident John Borg says this year's breakup was much tamer.
Not very exciting, no high water. This one looked like the water even got on the bottom of the retaining wall. And everything is moving on by us in good shape. So I don't think we're having any repeat of last year.
Borg says conditions this year were dramatically different from last year when the river had frozen high and abrupt spring warming sent a torrent of melt water and heavy ice through Eagle. The community's waterfront and old Native village site were wiped out. Borg says some remaining work on new houses built on higher ground last summer will be completed this season.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. North Rim Bank, reminding you that you have a second chance to help other Alaskans. If you filed for your PFD online, you can safely donate a portion of your dividend to your favorite Alaska cause. Log into the PFD website and pick, click, give. And by the University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu.
An average wildfire season is forecast for Alaska. A recently released outlook from the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center cites varying spring snowpacks, forecasts for above average temperatures, and uncertain precipitation across the state. Predictive Services meteorologist Sharon Alden says below normal snowfall over a large area of the interior raised early season wildfire risk, but summer weather is the primary factor dictating wildfire activity. Alden says that's hard to predict given the state of a key factor that affects the weather.
We were in sort of a moderate to strong El Nino through most of the winter. We're weakening and going to neutral conditions. And in the past, where we've been sort of where we are with respect to the southern oscillation and El Nino, we've had very low fire seasons and we've also had very busy fire seasons. So that is not going to be a good indicator for us this season.
Alden says an unexpectedly rapid transition to El Nino last summer resulted in one of the driest Julys on record and above normal fire activity. 527 fires burned 2.9 million acres in Alaska last summer. If this summer sees similar dry weather, Alden says vast stands of beetle-killed spruce on the Kenai and around Anchorage are especially susceptible to dangerous fires. The preseason forecast was put together last month by Alaska, NOAA, and the National Weather Service climate specialists. A tiny Alaska visitor that seems to fascinate birders and non-birders alike is the Rufous hummingbird. KRBD's Maria Dudzak recently spoke with Ketchikan bird enthusiast Steve Heinel about the Rufous hummingbird to find out more about its habits and behavior.
Steve Heinel, a fisheries biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, has had an avid interest in birds all of his life. Heinel annually leads bird walks as part of Ketchikan's Alaska Hummingbird Festival and has made presentations about birds during the Discovery Center's Friday Night Insight programs. Heinel says people are probably drawn to and fascinated by the hummingbird because of its size and behavior.
They're tiny. I don't even know how much they weigh, but it's, you know, hardly anything. And they laid little tiny eggs that aren't even a half an inch long. And they're also bursting with energy, and they have a lot of character. They'll readily come to a hummingbird feeder. You can see them up close, and you can see them interact. And they're very territorial, and they interact with each other often in a loud way with their chattering calls and that. And so I think that's why people are attracted to hummingbirds, because they do have a lot of personality.
Heinel says the Rufous hummingbird is the species most commonly seen in southeast Alaska. He says they migrate from Mexico, with the males arriving first.
We have males regularly showing up here at the end of March in most years, and they become common by, you know, early to mid-April. That's well ahead of most of the songbirds that that breed around our area. The females follow shortly after that, and then they're here, they breed and they nest, and then they migrate south fairly soon, too. They're one of the first migrants in our area to depart the area. The males leave by early July. I think our latest date that we've recorded a male is July 7th. By mid-August, almost all the hummingbirds are gone.
Heinel says despite its small size, the Rufous hummingbird is an extremely hardy and capable flyer. He says Rufous hummingbirds have been found in Alaska as far north as Girdwood, and its migration from southern Mexico to south coastal Alaska is one of the longest migrations of any hummingbird in the world. Heinel says if lucky, one might spot a hummingbird nest nestled in a sheltered branch.
They have a really beautiful little nests that they build. The females do all the nesting. The males, they just mate with the female, and then they migrate. So the females pick a nest site, and they build a little cup nest out of lichens and moss, and it's all held together by spider webs. It's tiny, of course, and they usually lay two eggs. It takes about a month from laying eggs to when the young fledge.
For those wanting to attract hummingbirds to their homes, Heinel says he knows of no ideal type of feeder that works better than any other. He says both store-bought and simple homemade feeders seem effective. Heinel says the feeder should be placed in an area where it's protected from the wind, but can easily be seen by the hummingbirds. He says color can make a difference.
Hummingbirds, like, they're curious about red-colored flowers and red, and it's not uncommon for people to be wearing a red baseball hat or something and have a hummingbird come and buzz around their head. And so they investigate red, but they also are attracted to flowers of other colors as well, like yellow flowers. If there's something on your feeder that looks like a flower where they're supposed to put their bill into the feeder, that I think that would be a good cue for them as well.
When preparing nectar, Heinel recommends using a solution of one part sugar to four parts water. He says if not eaten, the solution should be replaced about once a week to avoid mold growth. Heinel says he's often asked how late in the season a hummingbird feeder can be left up. He says it's not harmful to leave a feeder out all summer long.
People are afraid that if they leave their hummingbird feeder up, the hummingbirds won't leave. But I just don't think there's any basis for that, actually. And hummingbirds will visit your feeder, but they're also eating insects, and they visit flowers that are sources of nectar that exist in the wild for them as well. So they're not just going to be subsisting on your hummingbird feeder. And, you know, when it's time to migrate, that urge overtakes any urge they have to feed at your feeder, I think, and mostly they will migrate.
Heinel says there is at least one other species of hummingbird that visits Alaska, the Anna's hummingbird. Heinel says it arrives in the fall and often will stay over winter.
They're larger and they're green. They're Rufous hummingbirds, like the name would suggest, are usually orangish. Even the females have orange on them. But Anna's are a little bit larger, and they're all green-colored. And then the males have a rose-colored head, throat, and their crown. But they show up well after usually our Rufous hummingbirds leave. So if you see a hummingbird at your you forgot to take your hummingbird feeder down, or You see a hummingbird in your yard in October or November or even during the winter, it's almost certainly an anise hummingbird and not a rufous hummingbird.
Though the anise hummingbird is an occasional winter visitor, it's the rufous hummingbird that most Alaskans will have the opportunity to see and hear. Heinel says they can be very vocal, and if you listen, you can hear the distinctive ping from the wings of a male hummingbird as it darts off in flight. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
Fairbanks composer John Luther Adams has received a major honor. Adams is the recipient of the 2010 Michael Ludwig Nemers Prize in Musical Composition. The biennial award honors outstanding classical composers. Adams, who's resided in the Fairbanks area for 30 years, is known for giving voice to Alaska in his music. He says he was stunned to get news of the award, which includes a $100,000 prize.
For most of my creative life, I've worked in relative isolation up here in Alaska, and it's profoundly gratifying to know that my music seems to resonate out there in the larger world.
Adams has been the recipient of numerous awards and fellowships in the past, and he says Nemers Prize will not change what he does. He says he's grateful for the opportunity it affords him to continue working on a range of projects.
I'm working on a new CD that will be released in September, and I'm starting work on a new piece for Glenn Kochi, the drummer of the band Wilco. That's going to be a big piece for Glenn with electronics. And I've got performances coming up in Chicago and New York City in the coming year, and believe it or not, I've started work on my third book, which is a kind of atlas of my life here in Alaska and elsewhere.
Adams will also be busy teaching. The Nemers Award includes a series of four residencies at Northwestern University beginning this fall. Adams is a former percussionist with the Fairbanks Symphony and was composer in residence with the Anchorage Symphony in the mid-1990s. He says Alaska remains central to his work, and he's found music here he couldn't have composed anywhere else. And that's it for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Lori Townsend from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.